Okay, let's pick up where we left off in 1 Timothy chapter 3. As you know, in going through this book of Timothy, just keep something in mind, because I think it's important that you kind of understand the purpose for Paul writing these epistles. And the reason he basically addressed Timothy or wrote him a special letter was because, remember, when Paul was called over to Macedonia, he had left Timothy in charge in Ephesus. So he needed to give Timothy some instructions and firsthand information as to how to conduct a church, how to run a church, the type of people that were supposed to be overseeing in a church or conducting the services. He was giving him all of these different details and all these different kinds of information because the church was really in its infancy, and it really needed, I think, some guidance and direction, because people were, especially the Corinthian church, when Paul had to take them to task for a number of things. But even, I guess they were having their problems over there at Ephesus, because Paul had to make sure that he made himself abundantly clear that women weren't to be overseers or to be preaching to men and to be in positions of spiritual leadership where they were teaching. Now, when we get into chapter 3, you still see a lot of these instructions that Paul is giving to Timothy in regards to the church. All right? Now, there's an interesting thing. I read a long, long time ago, there was a sociologist. I can't even remember her name. Anyway, she wrote a book, and she was talking about rituals. And she basically concluded that the family that has the most rituals generally is a family that is a much closer-knit family, a family that is bonds much better, a family that is less likely to disintegrate or to be dysfunctional. And they even carried this over to the churches, as far as churches that have certain rituals. And I'll give you some examples. Okay, one thing that makes children feel secure is rituals. I know when Caleb was just a real small baby, I had a ritual with him. Every night, I'd have to give him a bath, and then after the bath, I'd give him a little bowl of ice cream, and we'd watch a little bit of TV, just as long, only 3, 4, or 5 minutes until he finished his ice cream. And then I would take him into bed, and I'd give him a juice. Otherwise, he didn't want to go to bed without juice. I'd give him a juice, and then I'd pray with him, okay, and I'd lay there with him, and as soon as he'd go to sleep, then I'd get up. But it was kind of a ritual where if any part of the ritual was missing, he couldn't go to sleep. Because in that ritual, he found a sense of security. He found a sense of well-being, a sense of order and structure that made him feel secure and loved. And as he got older, of course, the ritual somewhat changed. When he got older, then the ritual was that I would have to go to bed and read to him. And so I would read to him every night, just a little portion of, usually Bernstein Bears or whatever. And I remember sometimes I'd be so tired. I'd be just so exhausted, but I'd have to go through this ritual. And I'd be reading this thing, and I'd say, and they got in a bus and so on. And he'd say, no, it's just way in the back of the bus. He would be correcting me. But it was like when you do this ritual, it's like they got to have it in order to really feel that security. Well, you do this with kids. Now we still do it with them. We still have rituals as a family. And I'm just trying to bring home a point of how important it is to have structure, to have order, to have a sense of design, not only within the family, but also within the church. Now, I know that my particular church, as well as with Lutherans and Episcopalians and the Greek Orthodox and others, they're very rich as far as rituals are concerned. And they have found that churches that usually have a heavy emphasis on rituals, those churches usually have a great deal more loyalty in terms of their membership. Churches that are more loosely knit, when I say loosely knit, I'm talking about churches like, let's say, the Pentecostals or the Assemblies of God and other churches where, when I mean loosely knit, I mean there's not a lot of structure. If you go into the church, you don't know if they're going to kick it off with a prayer or a song or a testimony or whatever. And that's, God can work in all these situations. I'm not putting one down above one above the other. I'm just simply saying that if you look at rituals, they do have a real adhesiveness as far as the group is concerned. And it gives the group a sense of identity, a sense of order, a sense of structure that makes them loyal. Now, here's the big drawback to rituals. Rituals can become very, very mechanical. And rituals can become so mechanical that they become virtually meaningless. However, if you really look at the rituals, you can see that they're very, very rich in symbolism, and you can get a great deal out of them if you are determined not to become mechanical about them. All right, and the reason I'm saying all this is because Paul was in the process of establishing these various churches, okay? He was setting down guidelines. He was setting down instructions. He was giving them commands and exhortations and admonitions on how to conduct church services and who was to conduct it and how it was supposed to be done. And he made it abundantly clear that God is a God of order and things were to be done in a very orderly fashion. All right? So keep all this in mind, because I think that we need to have that kind of understanding of how the churches have evolved today. And I think there's just a lot of, let's say, unwarranted criticisms a lot of times. One denomination putting down another because they do certain things a certain way. Understand that, you know, God has his purposes there, and even if a church is very heavy in ritualism, doesn't mean that God isn't working there. Because if you go back in the Old Testament, God was very, very, very emphatic about a lot of rituals. And one of the things that they had to do, for example, was the Feast of Booths, where the families had to live in a tent for a few nights, and this was a ritual that was done in order to instruct the newer generations. As this is what our forefathers had to do when they came out of Egypt and they were, you know, wandering in the desert, and this is why we're celebrating this, to commemorate that. Okay, it has a really a tremendous impact upon children as far as reinforcing a lot of spiritual principles. I just had to get that kind of background in when we're going through Timothy, because, you know, when you understand where Paul's coming from, I think you can appreciate more of what he has to say. So he says in that verse 1 in chapter 3, but Paul says, it is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer or actually bishop, it is a fine work he desires to do. Okay, and he's just saying something else up front, that anyone who aspires or has the ambition or desire to be an overseer, in other words, somebody who would really conduct the affairs of God's people or God's church, that's a good thing to aspire for, okay? And so he's all for that. However, Paul puts some guidelines down of what this person, you know, should be like, some qualifications. Paul is putting a tremendous emphasis upon character in what he's writing here, isn't he? Everything to him is character. Okay, you have to be able, you have to be capable, you have to have the ability, but he's putting character far above any natural talents or ability. And when he says here, if a man aspires to be an overseer, well, he obviously is talking about the church. He's not talking about the government. However, I really do believe there is an application there, that for somebody who's going to be in a political authority, really should be a person of character as well. There's no question about it, okay, because God puts an enormous premium on character. And as far as Paul is concerned, if certain individuals do not meet these requirements as far as their character is concerned, then they are disqualified from becoming leaders. Now look at this thing that he writes as far as you know what he's looking for here. He says in verse 1, an overseer, or aptly a bishop, then must be above reproach. What is reproach? Reproach is something where you can accuse somebody of something, of a fault, or having done something wrong, okay? Now, nobody's perfect. We all understand that, okay? But when he's talking about an overseer must be above reproach, in other words, he can't have these skeletons in his closet or something where it's going to come back on him that is going to discredit his authority. He really needs to be a man who lives a life that he's no longer, he doesn't give an occasion for God's enemies to blaspheme or for weaker Christians to stumble. Now, let me clarify this, okay? A person can have lived a very sinful life and then come to Christ and get turned all the way around, and they can become an overseer in time, all right? I'm not talking about a past before you become a Christian. I'm talking about, well, once you're a Christian, you're going to have to live a life that is, you know, is above reproach. It doesn't mean you have to live a perfect life, because none of us can do that, all right? But you can't be in a situation where something's going to come back on you. You can't live in an adulterous affair as an overseer, because you're not living above reproach. It's going to come back on you, because the Bible says very plainly, he says, hey, you know, be sure your sin is going to find you out. So it's very important then to live that kind of life. You're going to have to walk the walk. You just can't talk the talk. You got to walk it. And he says here that he must be above reproach, the husband of one wife. Okay, that's a requirement. a qualification for being an overseer, husband of one wife. Now, there could be a few, ways to interpret this, okay, but I really believe the meaning is pretty clear as far as I'm concerned. When it talks about a husband of one wife, it doesn't mean that, well, you have to be married, for example, like Paul was not married. It's believed that at one time he was, but he was widowed. And the reason that people sometimes believe this is because Paul said that he was once a member of the Sanhedrin. And according to Jewish requirements, you had to be a married man to be on a part of that Sanhedrin. So it's speculated that he was once married and then he was widowed. So in other words, not saying you have to be married. It's just simply saying that if you are, you could be the husband of one wife. And the suggestion there is that you can't be divorced. You can't live in a polygamous relationship. That's a requirement that he's setting forth. Now let's look at today. We're in a situation where over 50% of the marriages are ending in divorce. As a matter of fact, in California, it's almost 2 out of 3 marriages ending in divorce. And getting to a situation now where people are getting divorced and married over and over and over again. As far as Paul is concerned, that would really disqualify a man from being in a position of spiritual leadership. He says he's to be a man of temperance, or he's to be temperate. What does that mean?
Given to extremes.
Good. He's to be moderate, whether you're eating or drinking. He's to be kind of self-restrained in his actions, in his speech. In other words, his life is to be kind of characterized by moderation. All right, and that could even include emotions. We had a guy who used to come to Bible study, a real dear friend of mine. And I think some of us here remember him, John Allen. I loved him so much, but he was a guy who was always given to emotion. He's always, either way up high or way down low. And I spent so many hours trying to encourage him and counseling and everything, but he just seemed to be always at extremes, And I think some of you know where he eventually just committed suicide. And it was a very sad thing. I think it got one of his low lows, and he just took a knife and just boom, boom, boom to himself. I mean, this is the kind of extreme that he was at. Well, if a person is that way, kind of up and down emotionally, there's an instability there that would really disqualify a person, I believe, as being an overseer. So he's talking about moderation in a lot of areas of our life. He's also talking about being prudent. What does that mean?
Good.
Exercising sound judgment. Don't you wish our politicians and judges and lawyers today were prudent men? It is so hard to find anyone in a political office, or especially in our courts today, to show any prudence. In other words, any common sense and sound judgment. So many of the decisions that are coming forth today, you just shake your head in total disbelief that these people are running the show. It's just incredible, isn't it? Well, you look at the church, and it's just a tremendous need for what? For prudence, for sound judgment, for common sense. And that's what Paul says, this is the type of person he must be. He says he must be respectable. What does that mean?
Somebody you can hold in high esteem.
Yeah. Right, and when a person is respectable, in other words, they carry themselves in a way that you deem them worthy or deem them with respect. I know that the Bible does say that a man judges by outward appearance, God judges by the heart. But I do believe, too, that the way a person conducts themselves, carries themselves, comes across, okay, the clothes that he wears, everything tells a lot about the person. And I do believe that what he's referring to is that, if you're going to be in a position of an overseer or a pastor, minister, priest, or whatever, you can't, let's say, dress like a slob, run around with tattoos all over the place, earrings dripping off you, and bone in your nose, and all this kind of stuff. You have to present yourself in such a way that you are representing your Father in heaven. And he says, he used to be hospitable. And I remember something about this, too, is that in the early church, they didn't have church buildings where they would meet, of course, like we do every week. Instead, they met like we're meeting now, in the home. And very often, that's where the church would gather, in the home. So a person who was going to be in a position as an overseer or an elder really had to have that qualification where they were hospitable to strangers, that they would welcome new people into their homes, and they would make them feel part of the family, or make them feel very much part of the group, very welcome. Okay, this was something that was... it was almost essential. But not only that, you keep something in mind that you see the heart of God in a hospitable person. Because who's more hospitable than God? I mean, I look around and I look at this world that He has created for us, for man, and you see a God who is incredibly hospitable by everything that He's provided for us. And also, one of the qualifications is that He's able to teach. All right? This makes common sense to me, okay? If a person is going to be in a position where they are going to have to lead, they have to have the ability to teach, all right? Not everybody has that ability. Everybody has different abilities or, you know, gifts that God has given us. But I do believe that a person, you know, if a person is going to be in a position of a preacher or an overseer, you know, he has to do what? The Bible says, study to show yourself approved unto God. Put yourself in a position where you really take your job serious in terms of imparting knowledge and insight and discernment and understanding to who? To the very people you're supposed to be spiritually leading. I mean, it doesn't say a lot for you if the people that are sitting in the pews know so much more than you. I think that you have to be able to instruct them in the way that they should go. And he also says that, verse 3, he says, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, not addicted to wine. To be addicted means, you know, an uncontrolled appetite for something, okay? It doesn't say that they are forbidden to drink any alcoholic beverages, because when we read further on in Timothy, as a matter of fact, Paul tells Timothy, take a little wine for your stomach on occasion, because it's good for you, and apparently Timothy probably was getting ulcers over the situations with the churches, and it was just for medicinal purposes. Paul even told Timothy to take some wine. And I'm not trying to put a plug in for alcoholic beverages. I'm just simply saying, you know, we have to have an intellectual honesty to just simply say, okay, there's not a prohibition here. It's just simply an admonition to say, okay, a person in a position of spiritual leadership must be a man of moderation in everything. So, I mean, we really do need to look at this from the perspective that I think God is setting forth for us. He says here, not to be pugnacious. What's that mean? Well, a pugnacious person is somebody who is always eager to fight, always wants to quarrel, always wants to be contentious, always wants to pick an argument. I remember Phil used to be like that when he came in. He's really mellowed out. I used to think, here comes pugnacious Phil, you know, and here we go again. Boom, boom, boom. But Phil is definitely... Yeah, they probably do, you know. But, you know, when I was reading this, this is the latest Time magazine. I couldn't help but think of this lady here. Where's Madeline? Okay, we heard Madeline Marie O'Hara. Right? Remember her? She was about the most pugnacious person you would ever want to meet. As a matter of fact, I think that back in the early 60s, she was considered the most hated woman in America. One person described her, you know, as he says, she's got the face of a bowling ball that's looking down, forever looking to strike down some pins. I mean, you know, she was just a quarrelsome, contentious, argumentative person that just, you know, I think has been responsible for so much of the disintegration of this country's morals. I really do believe
you
that.
Mean Madeline Marie O'Hara?
Yeah, right.
We didn't hear that.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Madeline Marie O'Hara. Anyway. No, she's missing. She's presumed dead. Okay. But what's interesting, I read in this article here, is he started this Atheists of America Club and all of these other offshoots of these different atheistic groups. But from what I read here, it's like their organizations, the people in the organizations so often would be at each other's throats, and they would be argumentative. They all had this characteristic of being pugnacious, to being rude, to being arrogant, to being contentious, to being quarrelsome. And they were always even fighting among themselves. And, you know, you just say, well, here's, they've totally blasphemed the Prince of Peace, and there's no peace there. The reason I'm mentioning this, when I think of a pugnacious person, here's a person who's just, you know, epitomizes that kind of character. Well, you can't have somebody like that trying to be an overseer in a church, forever argumentative and contentious and stuff like that, because we look at Christ. Christ says, "Learn from me, for I am meek and gentle of heart." A prediction about Christ was that a bruised reed he would not bend, and a smoldering wick he would not put out, meaning that when Christ was on earth, you know, he was very gentle, very reserved. So when he talks about a bruised reed and a smoldering wick, it was symbolically speaking of people who were either broken and demoralized mentally, emotionally, spiritually, physically, financially, or whatever. Jesus, even though he was all-powerful, he was very, very gentle, very, very kind, very, very understanding. And this is what Paul is saying that overseers are to be like. And a gentle person is basically refined. He's courteous. He's kind. He's patient. He's not harsh or rough or rude. A gentle person is just, to me, a person who can actually relate to people in a way, even if the person, let's say, is way below another person's, let's say, social and economic or intellectual or educational background or whatever, they treat the other person as an equal. That, to me, is another form of being gentle, to show that kind of kindness, consideration, thoughtfulness, that type of thing. He says, uncontentious, and being contentious is the same thing as a person who's always disputing. There is a difference between saying being pugnacious. Being pugnacious is you're just looking for a fight. You're rude, you're arrogant, you're constantly argumentative. Well, a contentious person is argumentative. They're looking for disputes or something to dispute about or to wrangle about. Well, this is something that Paul says stay away from. Or if a person is like that, you're not to be a position of leadership. Because let's face it, that type of person, you get that type of person started, it can be a tremendous drain upon any spirituality in the congregation, can it? Because you can get off on tangents arguing and disputing about what? And Paul told us it earlier in Timothy. Stay away from these kind of people. Stay away from these kind of meaningless disputes, because they lead to what? A total lack of spirituality. He says in that verse 3 as well, it says, free from the love of money. To be free means basically what?
Not controlled by.
Good. You're not under the control or the power of a certain, organization, person, thing, nation, whatever. When you're free, okay, you're not under another's control or something else's power or influence or control, right? So you look at money, and we are told that the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. Some Bible says the love of money is the root of all evil. And let's face it, money, it has a tremendous tenacity to it, and it's very, very, can be very, very subtle. I mean, I remember reading years ago, and I think I mentioned this a couple of retreats, about there was a survey done with a number of people that said, how much money would it take you for you to go to bed with a total stranger? And for the average man, it was $10. For the average woman, it was $10,000. But it seemed like the higher the dollar amount went, the more people were willing to prostitute themselves for the sake of monetary gain. In other words, by the time you got to $1 million, virtually everybody was willing to go to bed with a total stranger. Well, see, God is not interested in dollar amounts. He just wants to know, are we willing to disobey him for a price? We got to look at a situation and look at it and say, is there something that we'd be willing to disobey God on for enough money? You see, the love of money is so subtle that a lot of us never even consider it. That would be a problem with us, or that would be a sin for us. It is very, very subtle. Remember what Jesus talked about the sower and seed. He talked about some seed fell among thistles and thorns, and when they grew up, they were choked out, and they could no longer bear fruit. What did he say the thistles and the thorns represented?
Cares of the world.
And what? The cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches. He said the deceitfulness of riches. What is the deceitfulness of riches? Right.
And you only need
a little bit more. There it is. Yeah. There it is. You see, it's like the proverbial carrot dangling before the horse's nose. You know, he if I just run a little faster, a little harder, a little longer, I'm going to finally get there. Make money with money, then make more money with more money and more money. Well, how much is enough? Remember when the manna would rain down from heaven and God would provide his people with manna? all right? God gave them some very specific instructions. He said, don't take more than you need for today. Some people thought, well, gee, you know, I'm going to get out there and get plenty on hand, because what if it doesn't come back? What if there's no manna tomorrow? So they would gather up lots of it. And the following day, everything they had left over would become rancid, would become worm-eaten, would become rotten, would become smelly. This is the judgment God brought on these people who tried to hoard it. All right? And it was interesting that people who didn't gather much always had enough. But God was trying to show them a spiritual principle of relying upon Him for their daily needs. He told them that they were to gather only what they needed for the day. However, on Friday, they were to gather twice as much. Why? So on Saturday, it would be a day of rest. It was a Sabbath day. They wouldn't need to go out there and gather at work. So, in other words, it was a miracle in itself that any other day that they had left over, it would become rancid except for that day. What was God trying to show them? Exactly what Jesus was telling us in the Our Father. Give us this day our daily bread. Okay? We always say, oh, Lord, give me the next 10 months, you know, so I can feel a little, you know, get a little buffer, feel a little secure. I mean, we always like that idea, right? Right? Have a little nest egg, have a little backup. But the more that we have, the tendency is the less we become dependent upon God, or the less we really acknowledge God. That's why Jesus said, he said this, and I'm not the one that said it. He said, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Because when people who are rich, and they, you know, they have all the money that they could possibly use, there's a tendency there to, you know, give them a false sense of security, and therefore they forget God. So we kind of went off on tangent here, but that love of money, I think it says a lot about us. Is there a certain dollar amount that if we were guaranteed we'd be given it, would we be willing to disobey God about that? We have to ask ourselves, you know. Okay, in verse 4, it says, he must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. I think that's pretty self-explanatory, and I think it's very wise. I mean, if you've got somebody who's got a household, it's like an insane asylum, and the kids are running the institution, what is the show of the man? I mean, if you can't control your own house, and you can't manage your own household, you can't manage your own affairs, man, you got no business trying to manage the church affairs. Okay, it says in verse 5, it says, but if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? And that's just what we were discussing. And then he says in verse 6, it says, and not a new convert, lest he become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. You know, that's a very solid, sound piece of advice. It's not just a piece of advice. It's not just a suggestion. It's basically a command. You know what? The church, I've seen them do this time and time and time again. And they do tremendous disservice to the individuals and to the people. You know, you ever notice how many times, I mean, I've seen this over the years, that, let's say, an athlete, you know, or some celebrity will so-called become a Christian. The next thing you know, they've got all these publishing houses pounding on our door saying, oh, man, give us your life story and we'll have your picture all over it. The cover and everything like that. You ever see that? Right? And these people are just bathed in the Lord, but they put him in position to promise. And the church has a tendency to do this too. Let's say some wealthy businessman becomes a Christian in the church. Say, oh, man, put him on our board. And what's the real motive there? Well, the guy's got money. The guy's influential. Paul's saying, no, you don't do that. The man needs to be tested. His faith needs to be tested. He can't be a new convert, because you put him in these positions. The tendency there is that he's going to become conceited. He's going to become proud. He's going to become prideful. And he says he's going to fall under the same condemnation that the devil fell under. All right? I think it's just sound advice. I think, like I said, the church has a tendency to do this. It's just our human way of thinking, right? When somebody influential, somebody rich, somebody powerful, some celebrity, some athlete comes to the Lord, man, it's like everybody wants to catapult him just that much more into the limelight, thinking they're gonna somehow ride in on his coattails, but it's a big mistake. He says, Verse 7 says, and he must have a good reputation with those outside the church so that he may not fall into the reproach of the snare of the devil. He's supposed to have a good reputation with those outside the church. That's sound advice to me. In other words, take, for example, on your job. If in your church you're going to have a position of being an overseer or a deacon or an elder or somebody who's supposed to be helping run and conduct affairs within the church, if you have a job and you have a notorious reputation on your job for being irresponsible, for being unpunctual, for being, for not being conscientious, for failing to give your employee an honest day's work, or if you're contentious, or if you're pilfering from your employer. I mean, outside of the church, if people look at you and say, you know, this guy is the biggest worthless, good-for-nothing slob I've ever had work for me. What does that say when their boss finds out that, oh yeah, well, he's a deacon in his church? Where's the testimony there? But for the boss to say, you know, this guy is the most dependable, the most trustworthy, the most conscientious, the most diligent, the most hardworking, honest person I've ever had work for me. And then he finds out he's a deacon in his church. That says something, doesn't it? Says something both ways. So when Paul is talking about here, he's supposed to have a good reputation with those outside the church. That's for good reason. He says so that it may not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil, because it's going to become a snare, right? The devil's going to be able to use this to keep other people from becoming Christians. He says in verse 8, says, deacons likewise must be men of dignity, not double-tongued or addicted to much wine or fond of sordid gain. What's the difference basically between a bishop and a deacon and an overseer and a deacon? Basically, I think the difference is this. If you've got a pastor, a minister, a priest, a bishop, an overseer, they're basically different from a deacon or an elder in this respect. A deacon or elder usually is a lay person working within the church. Well, here Paul, again, he's setting down some very, I think, practical guidelines for people who are supposed to be running the church. If you've got elders, they're lay people in positions of leadership and authority. He gives some sound advice of what they're supposed to be like. He says that they'd be men of dignity. And basically, what does he mean by that? Well, they'd be men of dignity. I mean, they're to be honorable men. They're to be respectable men. And he says here that they must be. It's not just an option. It's not just a suggestion. They must be men of dignity, not double-tongued. What does that mean? Don't you wish this would be a requirement for these politicians? Saying one thing, doing another, or saying one thing to one group of people or one individual and saying a totally different thing to another person or another group. I mean, this is double-tongued. A person who's really not a person of the word. They're forever talking out of both sides of your mouth. You never know when to believe them. When they translate the Bible into various languages, you know, sometimes they've had some difficult times in translating certain words into different languages. But one thing that translators have never, ever had a problem with translating is the word hypocrite. Because in every tongue, in every nationality, in every language, everybody knows what a hypocrite is. Either man of forked tongue, man of double speech, man of two faces, man of two mouths. You know, I mean, you know, there's always some way to describe a hypocrite. And very often he's talking about here, a double-tongued man is also a hypocrite. He says, or addicted to much wine. Again, here's the admonition. Being addicted. Addicted is something that has control over you. And that type of person is not supposed to be in a position of spiritual leadership. Or fond of sordid gain. What's sordid gain?
Ill-gotten.
Yeah.
That is not done in accordance with the law.
Right, right. It's something that's done underhanded. Look at the Baker scandal. When he was selling out all of these, I guess, vacation slots in this Heritage Foundation or whatever it was. The whole thing was kind of a scam to milk people of more money. Well, that's sordid gain. And I think that a man of God has got to be in a position where he turns his back on that, regardless of how tempting it may be.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be something always that's under the law. Sordid means dirty.
Right.
You know, how many people did you step on?
Right. Yeah, good point. And one thing about, you know, some things could be, you know, there's always the gray areas, isn't there? Always the gray areas here that can get us into trouble if we aren't consistently trying to be as honest as we possibly can be, whether we like it or not. Okay, verse 9, it says, but holding to the mystery of faith with a clear conscience, holding to the mystery of faith. What does that mean? He's, okay, the elder is supposed to be holding to the mystery of faith with a clear conscience. That's kind of a word strange, isn't it? The mystery of our faith is what? It's the fact that, okay, God became man. That is a mystery. The incarnation, God becoming man. That's the mystery of our faith. Even though faith itself is something that's beyond, let's say, I'm not going to say it's beyond reason, but it's beyond our tangible senses. So, in other words, we got to be committed to Christ, even though we've never seen him, and we take it on faith, and we live our lives in such a way that doesn't deny our faith in him with a clear conscience. In other words, a lot of people give God, Jesus Christ, mental assent. They acknowledge him. They can acknowledge him as a Savior. They can acknowledge him as a Son of God. They can acknowledge him as being God. But to acknowledge him with our minds is a totally different thing than to be committed to him in our heart. There's a lot of people acknowledge him with their mind, but they're not really living for him. They're not really following him. They're doing their own thing. And in consequence, it's a violation of their conscience. So he's talking about here holding fast to the mystery of their faith with a clear conscience. Verse 10, it says, and let these also be tested. Let them serve as deacons if they are beyond reproach. Here's one of the things that he says, let them also be tested. I think that's a very important aspect. In other words, he kind of goes hand in hand where he says, don't put a new convert in a position of an overseer or a position of authority because it'll go to his head. Well, he's likely to fall in the same condemnation that the devil did with his pride. It always amazes me when there's, I think of the retreats, I think of EA, I think of other outreaches or ministries where you can find certain people that what I would consider what you call what fair weather friends or fair weather Christians, when you know everything is going smooth or when everything's conducive to the way they would like things, then they can get really enthusiastic about the things of God or really very supportive. But then when the newness wears off or the thrill wears off, where are they? Where are they in the next retreat? Where are they, you know, when they said that they would be there? Or they would say that you could depend upon them, either for monetary support or otherwise, whatever. So, but a person who has showed themselves over a period of time to be faithful and to be dependable, to be trustworthy, this is the type of person he's talking about. That's that they've been tested and tried. Then they can serve as a deacon if they are beyond reproach. In other words, if they don't have anything that's going to come back on them, be a discredit to their testimony. And verse 11 says, women must likewise be dignified, not malicious gossips, but temperate, faithful in all things. He's talking about women. He's talking about women in general. But I do believe that under the context here, he's talking about overseers and elders. So he may very well primarily be speaking of the wives of elders and overseers. He's talking about women in general, but I do believe that there probably is a very specifically in this context, you know, the women that work side by side with these elders and overseers. Okay, which would be their wives. They are to be dignified and not malicious gossips. That's kind of an interesting way thing that he didn't say that about men. He talked a bit about men being double tongued, but he's talking here about women being malicious gossips. A man could be a malicious gossip. What does malicious mean?
With ill intent.
Yeah, or somebody who really their desire when they're speaking about somebody or gossiping about somebody is to, you know, ruin their reputation or undermine their reputation or to make them look bad. And I think someone once said that you know, a gossip is somebody who will never tell a lie as long as the truth can do as much damage. And when he talks about here for women. Now, men could be just as bad. I'm not trying to, you know, split hairs or sling hash over this. But here's something we've got to keep in mind. I think the reason he addresses women on this is because, by nature, women are more talkative. The average man speaks 12,500 words a day. The average woman speaks 25,000 words a day. Twice as much. The Bible says, where there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. So just by the basic difference between, you know, the man and woman, as far as conversation is concerned, there's always more of a danger to get involved in saying things against people or about people that really you got no business saying. So, and especially if he's a wife of an overseer or an elder, very often an overseer, a bishop, a pastor, a priest, an elder, maybe in a position where they counsel people or people come to them with their problems or come to them with their sins or whatever. And if the overseer happens to confide in his wife, the next thing you know, it's a secret that's all over the church, and then you got a real problem, right? So there has to be, you know, a kind of a teamwork there. And he says, women must likewise be dignified, not malicious gossip, but temperate, faithful in all things. Temperate, of course, like I said, women in moderation and faithful in all things. She's dependable. Okay, and in verse 12 says, let deacons be husbands of only one wife and good managers of their children and their own household. Again, a very, very similar, not just recommendations, but, you know, requirements for anybody in positions of church leadership or authority. And verse 13 says, for those who have served well as deacons obtain for themselves a high standing and great confidence in the faith that is in Christ Jesus. When you've proved yourself, you know, to be faithful, he says that you obtain for yourself high standing. In other words, you're going to develop a reputation that will basically precede you, really, in a sense, because it'll precede you on the way to heaven. You can't take anything with you but your reputation and what you do for Christ. He says in verse 14, he says, I am writing these things to you, hoping to come to you before long. But in case I am delayed, I write so that you may know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the church. We're winding it down now. Look at that 14 and 15 again. He says, I'm writing these things to you, hoping to come to you before long. But in case I am delayed, I write so that you may know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God. Now, isn't this the exact, he's telling us here the exact purpose that he has written this letter. That even though he wants to come back to Ephesus and be with Timothy and square things away personally, he figures in case I'm delayed or prohibited or prevented from coming, I'm writing this to you so that you will know what to do. About what? About conducting himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. That's why I was mentioning at the very beginning of this study tonight about how, well, I was talking about rituals, but I was talking about how important it is to establish, you know, order and design and structure within the church. And that's why Paul, that's what Paul is doing here. He says here in verse 16, and by common confession, great is the mystery of godliness. He who was revealed in the flesh was vindicated in the spirit, beheld by angels, proclaimed among the nations, believed on in the world, and taken up in glory. What he says here is really a mouthful. He says, by common confession, great is the mystery of godliness. What is he saying there? He's saying by common confession, and he lists these different situations or characteristics that I believe they become a witness in themselves, common confession. In other words, remember in the Old Testament, he says that everything was to be established by the witness of two or three witnesses. Okay, well here you've got different forms of witnesses in regards to Christ. He says the mystery of godliness here. The mystery, of course, goes back to the incarnation, God becoming man. And he says here, he who was revealed in the flesh, that's Christ. He who was revealed, remember, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And the Word was God. This is what he's referring to here. The incarnation. This is the mystery of godliness. He who was revealed in the flesh. Of course, that's Jesus. He was vindicated in the spirit. Meaning what?
Resurrected.
Right. But it doesn't mean he was resurrected in the spirit. This is what Jehovah's Witnesses preach. Okay? Jesus was resurrected in the flesh. Jesus was resurrected in his physical body. But he was vindicated in the spirit. In other words, when Jesus Christ rose from the dead, God showed the entire spiritual world as well as our world that everything that Jesus Christ proclaimed has been vindicated as being true. And he was vindicated in the spirit by being raised from the dead. It certified his credentials as being the Messiah, as being the Son of God. Everything that he taught, prophesied, and said, it certified him, it vindicated him in the spirit. He's beheld by angels. Remember at Jesus' birth, the angels announced to the shepherds about his birth. Remember when he was tempted of the devil for 40 days and then the angels came and ministered to him afterwards. He was ministered by an angel in the Garden of Gethsemane. He was proclaimed by angels at his tomb. They declared his resurrection. And let's face it, angels and devils observed him his whole life long. He was scrutinized, beheld by them, and watched by them. He said in verse, and the next one says, proclaimed among the nations. Not a nation on earth that hasn't heard of Jesus Christ. At least not to my knowledge. There may be some tribe somewhere, but, you know, he's proclaimed all over the world. Proclaimed among the nations, believed on in the world, and taken up into glory. And this is, he just basically is outlining Christ's whole mission in becoming man. All right? And he says that he was believed on in the world, even though the world crucified him, the world hated him. There were those in the world who believed on him, and then he was taken up into glory. You know, when the apostles were watching him, you know, go into the clouds and finally disappear. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?